Warren Buffett, BlackRock, and other institutional players dominate investments in commercial aviation. Why? Because it's one of the most profitable and predictable alternative assets that exists. And it's not tied to other markets, such as real estate and the stock market. Is it safe? Well, imagine triple net leases to the likes of American Airlines and British Airways. Income is contractual and guaranteed by some of the biggest named airlines in the world. That's why this kind of investment was never available to the ordinary accredited investor. That is until now. Visit accesswealthaviation.com and check it out for yourself. Invest in an institutional team with over 200 plus years of combined investment experience in the aviation sector. Conservative investing with double-digit returns and tax advantages. That's accesswealthaviation.com, accesswealthaviation.com.
You are listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast with Buck Joffrey. Get ready to change your life.
Welcome, everybody. This is Buck Joffrey with the Wealth Formula Podcast coming to you from Montecito, California. Today, before we begin, a reminder that we have a website that is associated with this podcast called wealthformula.com. And that's where you want to go if you want to sign up for some of the various resources we have, some of the lists, including the Accredited Investor Club, some interesting stuff coming down through the pipeline. Some of it you don't necessarily need to be in the club for because it is a certain type of offering that doesn't that you can publicize widely, but other things that you cannot require to be in that club. So I do encourage you, if you're interested in seeing some of the deal flow and that kind of thing that's coming up, to go to wealthformula.com and sign up for a Accredited Investor Club and get onboarded. By the way, there's a very interesting one that we've got actually coming through. This one you probably will hear about if you're on any email list, but that's in the triple net leasing of jumbo jet airline or aircrafts to, you know, like American Airlines and stuff like that. It's pretty neat and huge depreciation play. Check that out for sure. That one is at accesswealthaviation.com. Anyway, let's get to the meat of the show, which is the interview that we have lined up today. It's about math. You know, in the long run, math is pretty much always right. That's just the truth. If you look over time, over things that you need answers, questions to, math generally will give you the answer. Now, that's why insurance companies are so profitable. They make predictions using the law of big numbers, and they get these actuarial things going on, and it makes it so that they're consistently profit. That's why Warren Buffett loves them. Math can predict just pretty much anything, even sports, which is on my mind as of late with the National Football League having its free agent season. Kirk Cousins, Minnesota Vikings quarterback, previously signed an enormous contract with the Atlanta Falcons for something like $180 million over 4 years. And if you look at Kirk's numbers, they look pretty good, although the numbers that never showed up for him were playoff wins and, basically choking when it got into big games. So I don't know how the math can catch that, but maybe the Falcons analytics did not. Speaking of which, I watched this, rewatched this movie, Moneyball. I watched it last week again. I highly recommend it if you've never seen it. It's a really good movie. It's about the Oakland A's. They had this run back in 2002. In professional baseball is not like professional football where every team gets a certain amount to spend and that's all they can spend. To me, that's one of the reasons that NFL is so much fun to watch, because you can have the Green Bay Packers and Green Bay, Wisconsin competing with the New York Giants in New York. So you can't do that in baseball. If you're the Yankees, you get to spend a heck of a lot more. Anyway, the Oakland A's in 2002 2001 had lost some major players, and they were asked to compete, and basically they couldn't afford it, so they used analytics and hired this young nerdy guy, an economics major from Yale, to help them basically break down players by the numbers and look at them as pieces in a larger mathematical sequence that would help them win. And they made a huge run, even though they didn't have any like name players. So it was pretty interesting. But yeah, you know, the genius of applying mathematical principles, it isn't confined to the boardroom of these financial companies or baseball. It seeps into our everyday lives in ways that we probably might not initially recognize. Beyond, you know, sports and finance, math offers tools that help us navigate daily decisions and challenges, often without us even realizing that we're employing them. You know, math doesn't just predict outcomes. It helps us make informed decisions, maximizes our resources, and enhance our daily lives. It's not just about numbers and equations either. It's a vital tool, really, that when applied, you can solve some practical problems and make everyday tasks easier and more efficient. And of course, math can also be used and should be used in various ways as you move along your investment journey in personal finance. So this week's guest on Wealth Formula Podcast tells us a lot about this. He is an author of a book on mathematics and decision making. And he has a lot of interesting things to say that I think are things that you can apply to your own life and your own investing. And we will have that interview right after these messages.
What do the Rothschilds, the Romneys, and the billionaire hedge fund managers know that you don't about growing and protecting wealth? As you might imagine, the wealthy have a few tricks up their sleeves. One strategy allows you to grow wealth tax-free at a compounding rate with no volatility. It protects your money from creditors and lawsuits, and it lets you invest the same money in two different places at the same time. How about that for amplifying wealth? To learn more, go to wealthformulabanking.com. Again, that's wealthformulabanking.com.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Today, my guest on Wealth Formula Podcast is Kit Yates. He's a senior lecturer in the Department of Mathematical Sciences and co-director of the Center of Mathematical Biology at the University of Bath. He completed his PhD in mathematics at the University of Oxford in 2011, and he's also the author of How to Expect the Unexpected, The Science of Making Predictions, and The Art of Knowing When Not to, and The Maths of Life and Death. Welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
You know, this is obviously a broad topic. You know, at the core of it is the idea that, you know, math should hopefully improve your life. You start using it because humans, by nature, perhaps are poor at making predictions. Is that fair?
I think that's true. Yeah, I think that's really true. I think there's lots of places where we make mistakes, both mathematically, but also psychologically. I think part of the book is about how the numbers interface with our psychology and can lead us down sort of blind alleys and alerting people to those alleys.
Yeah. So why, you know, it sounds like you have some connection with the biology departments as well. I'm certain this is something to do with the way we're wired. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I mean, for example, we are hardwired to find patterns, perhaps where there aren't any in the numbers. And maybe this is a specious, the explanation, but the explanation goes that back in the day we were out hunting or gathering out in the jungle, in the woods, and you would hear maybe a rustle in the bushes, and you would maybe think, oh, there's a predator behind me, I'm going to run away. Maybe there wasn't a predator, maybe it was just the wind rustling the bushes, right? But by running away that one time in 100 when it was a predator, you survive, you pass on your paranoid genes to the next generation. We pick up these patterns where there perhaps aren't, because it's useful for us to do that. And for example, we see a face in the Man in the Moon, which is just craters on the face of the moon. But again, we're hardwired to recognize faces and to interpret people's emotions when we see those faces. And so we see these patterns where there aren't any, and then we jump to conclusions based on that. So it's called pareidolia, is where you find the patterns, and apophenia is where you then jump to a conclusion, draw two things together that maybe aren't related.
So let's use that concept as an example. If you see something rustling in the bushes and you're worried that it might be something that might want to eat you, in the modern world today, when would that not be of benefit to you to react according to your instincts?
So I think the problem is when we spot patterns in places where there aren't actually any patterns, where it's just randomness. So for example, gamblers often fall into this trap, right? Where you know, you're betting on roulette and you think, well, there's been three reds have come up in a row, so I'm going to go black instead because I think that, you know, it's time for black to come up. And it's a fallacy, right? It's no more or less likely for black or red to come up. So our reasoning about uncertainty, about risks, everyday risks that we might be taking, can be skewed by our perceptions of what randomness looks like. So not only are we not good at spotting randomness, but we're also not very good at being random either.
And technology, you would think, might make it easier for humans to make predictions, but I think you argue that it actually may be making it more difficult. Is that right?
Yeah, I think technology in the right hands can make predictions easier. For example, with weather forecasting, we're getting better supercomputers, which allow us to run better weather models with more detail, which means that we can predict further into the future. And the rule of thumb is that roughly every 10 years, we gain a day's worth of forecasting accuracy. So we can peer a day further forward into the future with the same degree of accuracy that we could do a decade previously. So I think that, yeah, technology can absolutely be of benefit, but only when it's used in the right hand.
So one of the selling points of artificial intelligence is that it's going to help humans make better predictions. Is that what's your take on that? Obviously, it's based on a lot of math, right?
Yeah, for sure. The mathematics underlying deep learning, artificial learning, artificial intelligence is Bayesian networks to some extent. So it's somewhat a model of how our brain learns from experience. There's lots of deep and interesting mathematics under there. So I think AI can be helpful, but at the same time, we have to be a little bit careful about how we use AI and how we employ it, because it's not perfect. It's not, you shouldn't just divest all of your decisions to artificial intelligence. There's a nice example in the book of how I ask it this problem about drying times for towels. So I say, you know, if you've got three towels, and it takes three hours for these towels to dry on the washing line, how long will it take nine towels to dry? And the truthful answer is, if your washing line is long enough, it shouldn't take any longer for nine towels to dry than three towels, because they're drying in parallel, right? But when I asked this to ChatGPT, it said, well, the drying time is proportional to the number of towels, so it should take 9 hours for nine towels to dry. And so it's using this, what's called a linear bias or a linear assumption, which is, we are all subject to this. We do make this mistake ourselves. But what I suppose it emphasizes is that actually ChatGPT or other AI large language models don't always get the answers right. And in some respects, they're subject to the same biases that we are as humans.
So, this show, obviously, we talk about personal finance, and this is an area where obviously trying to be able to make some predictions is something we're constantly doing, right? Or we're trying to figure out economic trends. Will interest rates go up? Will they go down? Will real estate prices go up? Will they go down? How can someone build, someone who's maybe not a mathematician, how can someone use math to build a framework for better thinking or decision making just for these types of things?
So I think in terms of economic models and economic forecasts, those things are incredibly complex, and they're not really in the realms of the individual to make really good stabs at those things, because there are so many variables going into them, which is why big banks employ not just one individual, they employ rafts of mathematicians to come up with algorithms to take in huge amounts of data. And, you know, big data is really important for making those sorts of decisions. That said,
and they're still often wrong, by the way.
Yeah, right. Even then, they still make mistakes. Right. In the same way that the weather forecasters, they put in huge amounts of data, they have very sophisticated models, and they still get it wrong some of the time, because partly because these systems are chaotic. And actually, you know what, it's better sometimes to appreciate that you're not going to have a good prediction than to rely too heavily on a prediction which turns out to be bad. So understanding the limitations, the places where we can actually make accurate forecasts, that's really super important. So, for example, with chaotic systems like the weather, and by chaotic, I mean not just like highly complicated, that's a sort of colloquial meaning, but I mean there's a specific mathematical definition which says that there's what's called sensitive dependence on initial conditions. So that means that two systems which start out really similar to each other can diverge really quite quickly. So the reason why weather forecasts have uncertainty associated with them is because we don't know precisely the initial conditions that we're putting into those models, and so very slight differences can lead to big changes, which is where this butterfly effect idea comes from. But yeah, so mathematics can help us, but actually more useful for us as individuals is probably understanding the biases that we're subject to, things like normalcy bias, where we believe things that will just continue as they are or change only very subtly. And actually the first chapter of the book, I go and visit a psychic to see how she tries to manipulate me into telling me that I know things that, or telling me she knows things about me that she actually doesn't. So I really learned a lot of psychology by going to visit her. Sorry, by going to visit this psychic.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Yeah, I can tell you more about that if you want.
Yeah, no, let's hear about the psychic.
Yeah, sure. So for the first book, what I really wanted to understand, because this book is all about predicting the future, I wanted to understand how people in the past were able to be soothsayers or seers or oracles without actually having access to any modern day scientific techniques that we have today. How were they able to do this when actually they really didn't have access to great tools? And the answer is that they tried to pull the wool over people's eyes, basically. They went around using tools which led to the impression that they could predict the future. So they did things like, if you wanted to predict something about someone's personality, you use what's called a Barnum statement, where you say something which is just generic and bland about them, like, you know, you're really an intuitive person, or, you know, you have
you just compliment people, right? And then they say, yeah, you're absolutely right, I am a wonderful person.
Sometimes you're really extroverted and sometimes you like to go into your shell. We all feel like that sometimes, right? And it's just like playing on these very common personality traits, and it elicits a psychological bias in us called the Forer effect, which is where we take a very generic statement and interpret it as very personal to ourselves. And it's named after this guy Bertrand Forer, who gave his students about 10 different, I sort of, it's called a personality assessment, 10 different statements he'd taken from a horoscope, from an astrology book, basically, and asked them to rate how well it fitted them. And they were giving it scores of like 9 out of 10, 8 out of 10, because these statements were very bland and they could see aspects of them, that in themselves. So that was one of the things that really struck me as of how to convince people that you know what you're saying when you don't. Flattery is part of it. And there's this thing called the rainbow ruse, where you say two complementary but opposite sides of the same personality trait. So sometimes you're very outgoing and sometimes you're very introverted. And of course, the extroverts will resonate with that, and so will the introverts. It's sort of subtle and simple things, but that's how they do these sorts of things.
Let's talk a little bit about, I think, you know, if we want to try to get some things that people can use, just talk about Bayes' rule. What is Bayes' rule? How can it help people make good decisions?
Yeah, so Bayes' rule is this way of reasoning about new evidence. I'm not going to go, there's a mathematical formula, but it's not hugely important. I mean, if you want to use it like technically, then it becomes a little bit more important to know the formula. But actually, there's some general rules and lessons that we can take from Bayes' rule about reasoning in the face of new evidence. And so one of those rules is that new evidence isn't everything. Okay, so we shouldn't forget what's called our prior beliefs on a subject and just be swayed by a single piece of new evidence. The flip side of that is that if you really want to reason like a Bayesian, then you have to commit to updating your opinion every time a new piece of evidence comes in. So it's really tempting when we're fairly set with our opinions to either only seek out information which accords with those opinions, or when a piece of information that comes across differently, which upsets our preconceived opinions, our priors, to say, well, I don't believe that, and to give that evidence no weight at all. But actually, it's super important to slightly adjust your opinion every time new evidence comes in, and Bayes' rule gives you a way of doing that. And it's really important that you keep updating your opinions as new evidence comes in. Otherwise, we become subject to things like confirmation bias, where we just ignore evidence which doesn't agree with what's happening. And the other thing to say is about Bayes' rule is that it suggests that you should never hold any opinion with 100% certainty. Because then Bayes' rule says there's no way of changing that opinion. This is why we have such a big problem with people like anti-vaxxers, people who are 100% certain of their opinion, people who are sort of climate science denialists, because they're so 100% certain of their opinion, no matter the amount of evidence you present them with to refute their claims, they give that evidence zero weight. So it's important, if you want to get decisions right, if you don't want to be on the wrong side of a decision, that you never hold any opinion with 100% total certainty.
Can we use an example on how a person might, you know, use Bayes' rule in a personal decision-making matter? Let's actually go through something, if you don't mind, just so that people kind of have a better framework.
So my example is not super serious, but... So I'm a big football fan, soccer fan in this case. And yeah. My team is Manchester City. I'm from Manchester originally. We bought at the end of last summer one of the hottest new talents in European football, a guy called Erling Haaland. He's been tearing it up in Germany for a couple of years. He's a really young guy, but he was scoring loads and loads and loads of goals. And he came in at the same time as Liverpool, another team in the Premier League, also bought a new striker, Darwin Nunez. Now, Nunez was good, but maybe not quite as good as Haaland. In fact, nowhere near as good as Haaland. The first game of last season, Manchester City, my team, with Erling Haaland, played Liverpool with Darwin Nunez. Darwin Nunez scored two goals. He scored one goal and he assisted another goal, whereas Erling Haaland didn't score any. He had a bit of a bad game, to be honest with you. But the newspaper headlines the next day were all Darwin Nunez, new superstar, wonder kid, Erling Haaland's going to struggle in the Premier League. He's just not suited to playing in the Premier League, despite the fact that he had been brilliant, right? So we're making this mistake of reasoning on a single piece of new evidence rather than remembering our prior beliefs of how good he was, his prior record. And as it happened, the rest of that season, Erling Haaland went on to score the most goals in the season in the Premier League. He won the Golden Boot in the in the Champions League. You know, he actually had the best season that any striker has ever had in the Premier League. So we shouldn't have forgotten all of that prior information on the basis of a single game. And so I would argue that if he doesn't score, then we also have to decrease our opinion of how good he is. But at the same time, we shouldn't make all of that new evidence everything. We shouldn't forget our prior beliefs.
When is it not appropriate to use mathematics in decision making? I think that's one of the things that I think that it's interesting. Sometimes you can get caught up in the math, but what if you're not looking at the right math? I guess that's the question.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think that's right. I mean, I think I would argue that often mathematics is a useful tool, especially when you're reasoning about data. Okay. But there are people who would advocate for using mathematical tools to choose who you should date and who you should marry. And for me, that is a bit of a bonkers idea. So there's this rule called the optimal stopping problem, which is about how you decide who the best person for a job is if you have to interview them sequentially and tell each person after the interview whether they're hired or not. So optimal stopping tells you how many people you should interview to get a sort of picture of what the pool of candidates is out there and what you should do when you should choose the next best candidate. But people have advocated for using this for choosing your partner. So assuming that you're going to date 30 people over the course of the next 10, 15 years, looking through the first third of them and then choosing the next best person after that. But who can really do that? You can't subject all of your life to mathematical algorithms. I'm a mathematician. Like, I love maths. I find it fun. I find it enjoyable. I find it super useful. But I would never advocate using it in huge swathes of my daily life. I think there are certainly matters where we need to trust to our hearts as well as our heads.
Yeah. Just switching a little bit over, since we do have so many medical folks in this audience, I'm curious on your, where you think we can improve, with healthcare and health-related decisions on a personal level. When it comes to using math?
Yeah, so I'm a mathematical biologist, so this is a subject really close to my heart. More generally, we are using maths to do all sorts of things, from modelling the way that drugs react with the heart, all the way through to trying to understand cancer better. So that's sort of big picture stuff of what maths is doing in the background. At the same time, we've talked about AI a little bit already. AI is going to be hugely helpful in diagnostics, for example, in interpreting x-rays to ease the pressure on radiographers so that we can maybe interpret where there is a cancerous tumor. Maybe we can diagnose diseases better using AI, and it's already out there in the medical field. But one thing that people can do as individuals is to get a really good understanding of risk and what risk really means, understanding how accurate tests can be. And actually, one of the most important things is to shatter what's called the illusion of certainty, right? So doctors often present us with the statistics which are related to our tests. And we, I think, sometimes just accept those numbers as hard pieces of truth because they've come from someone in authority. But actually what we should be doing is asking for more explanations around those figures, because actually doctors do a brilliant job, don't get me wrong, but doctors are not always the most numerate populations. Right. And so it's often the case that we need to get more context around the actual risks that are being presented to us by our physicians so that we can better understand the consequences of decisions that we're going to make.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that I find, because I'm sort of still steeped into this with another health-related podcast too, is like, for example, reference ranges, right? Reference ranges for normal and abnormal. And the example of you know, if you look at a hemoglobin A1C, which is predictive of, like, you know, what your blood glucose is over a period of 3 months, you know, we have these numbers basically, you know, once you hit, you know, it is, once you hit a certain number, you're a diabetic. But if you are, right, you know, 0.1 less than that, you are a pre-diabetic, and therefore you're treated completely differently. Yeah. And so these things are, I think they're, the more you understand those kinds of things, the more you can make some personal decisions on what to do with your own health. You may not be classified as a diabetic, but your risk may be the same as a diabetic because you're so darn close to being a diabetic.
Yeah, and absolutely. You know. Like we tend to binarize and so to see things in black and white, whereas actually it's multiple shades of gray. Like, presumably your risk increases incrementally or continuously, if you like, as those metrics change. It's not dissimilar to the use of body mass index to understand whether people are obese or morbidly obese or healthy weight or whatever. Actually, like, that's a population scale metric, which can tell you something at a population scale, but an individual level, using body mass index as an indicator of cardiometabolic health is really not that useful. But we still use it, and we classify people as obese and give them certain health interventions based on being just over or just under one side of this line. Similarly, when people are recovering from eating disorders, the classification is based on body mass index of whether they get help or whether they don't get help. And actually, it's not really helpful to do that sort of binarized one metric only. We really need, like, a more holistic picture of healthcare, I think, where we combine multiple metrics and don't try and just binarize a decision like that.
Yeah. And I think another example I think of actually as it relates to some of the studies on, you know, whether various diets work or various, you know, supplements work. And I think the complicated part in some of those questions ultimately becomes too, that these, as you know, biological systems are very complicated. So if you're looking at one drug in particular and trying to determine whether or not there is a effect on longevity there, you may get no result at all. But in fact, if you have that drug in with something else and there's a synergy there, you may find something that actually is a significant benefit. And so those are all challenges. Obviously, that's just trying to get back to this idea that, you know, there's some limitations. You got to constantly be thinking about, you know, the math will tell you a definitive answer. There's no question about a single question that you're answering, but the the challenge becomes, what's the question you're actually getting an answer to? Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's so much variability within others as individuals that we can't expect there to be a single formula which tells us all the answers to all of our health problems. I suppose the flip side of that is that mathematics really is coming in and allowing us to do more personalized individual based. Sure. So like we can scan people's hearts and potentially build in silico or computer models of their hearts and test how they may interact with particular drugs. We can do some sort of amazing things now in terms of personalized medicine. And, you know, that's all built on computer power and on mathematics at the end of the day. So hopefully maths and mathematical biology can come in and help with medicine.
What are those things that you're most excited about in terms of what's coming down the pipe, so to speak, in your world, as it relates to medicine and technology? Are there specific things that you're seeing that sort of may be coming up that we might kind of get a preview of?
Yeah, well, I think that artificial intelligence is going to be hugely, hugely influential. It already is starting to go down that road. But what I don't think we'll ever do is completely replace doctors and physicians, and I don't think we should hope to do that. But I think that actually we can assist them, and I think that will be hugely helpful, certainly in the NHS. In the UK, we've got a real shortfall of, for example, radiographers, and it would be really helpful if you use two radiographers to do a diagnosis of breast cancer, for example, to let the first scan be done by artificial intelligence, because we know that already, as of a few years ago, artificial intelligence can perform as well as human radiographers, and to have the second scan done by a person who can interpret the results and use their experience to understand that. Because not everything about a diagnosis is based on a single x-ray. It's this thing of not just using a single piece of new information to make a conclusion. It's about understanding that person's life history, about understanding how old they are, what risk factors they're affected by, as well as this new piece of information. And that's something that machines are maybe not that good at doing yet, but we as humans with our brains or inbuilt Bayesian filters are very good at doing that sort of thing.
Kit, the book again is called How to Expect the Unexpected, The Science of Making Predictions and the Art of Knowing When Not to. I assume it's available pretty much everywhere you can get books.
So, absolutely. Anywhere you want to buy a book, you should be able to find this. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, good luck with that, and love to have you on again sometime in the future.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for having me.
I'll be right back. Self-storage is a necessary evil. It's where you keep your stuff and forget about it. No wonder this stuff is so profitable and recession-resistant. The Wealth Formula community, well, we've benefited from that. We've made lots of money in this space with Reliant Real Estate, one of the largest self-storage companies in the country. With an average investor internal rate of return of almost 34%, with hold times just over 3.5 years, these guys know what the meaning of velocity of money is. If you're an accredited investor, make sure to check out what they're up to right now at ReliantFund4.com. Again, that's ReliantFund4.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Hope you enjoyed it. And before we go, I just want to remind you once again, if you are not already signed up for the Accredited Investor Club, make sure you do that. We have a bunch of interesting things coming down the pipeline, whether that it has to do with, you know, ATM machines that we talk about and aviation and apartment buildings. Obviously, eventually we'll get back into that, that sort of very slow market right now. And we're waiting for things to kind of fall from the trees so we can pick them up. And mergers and acquisitions, all sorts of interesting stuff coming up. So if you are an accredited investor, make sure to sign up. Go to wealthformula.com. And that's it for me this week on Wealth Formula Podcast. This is Buck Joffrey signing up.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast. Visit us on the web at wealthformula.com. The information contained in this podcast are opinions, not fact. As always, consult your own financial team before making any investment. See you next time.
Buck Joffrey here from Sapio with Buck Joffrey. Aging might become reversible over the next 10 to 20 years. It's already being done in lab animals, so it's just a matter of time. Our challenge? To be healthy enough for when that time comes. As a former scientist and surgeon myself, my goal is to figure out how to do that and to share it with you. I wrote a book called Living Longer for Busy People that you can download for free at sapiopodcast.com. You'll be amazed at just how a few daily adjustments can add years of a healthy life for you. Again, download it for free, sapiopodcast.com.